Okay, Oliver, take it away.
Yeah, good morning, councillors. For the record, Oliver Ojiako, Community Planning Director. So this morning, councillors, we just want to share with you, we are not asking you for any decision or any direction this morning. This is going to be an informational work session with you. This is what I will call check-in on what our vacant buildable lands model is telling us for 2018. Bob Poole will be the one giving the PowerPoint presentation this morning. What I will do is just briefly provide the council some background information. And that background information is that the vacant buildable lands model was developed by a group that the commissioners at the time put together, the development community and the environmental community. They started developing this vacant buildable lands model in early 1992 and 93. The first time that the county used the vacant buildable lands model was in 1994, the first growth plan. So we have had what I will call a 24 years experience with the data, and Bob can speak to this. So we started saving the data going back to, say, 1996. So if you want to see what have happened since 1996, that information is available. How do we use the model? It is a model, a planning tool that we use to tell us what is available in terms of residential or housing and then number of potential jobs in the urban growth boundary. That's really what the model does. There are some assumptions that are built into the model, and we can talk about that. So primarily, at any given time, and this model is also run, and Bob can speak to that, once every year, when the assessors go through what is called the assessors rollover, they go out in the field and they look at some properties and so forth, and they come back and load that information in the system. We call it the assessors rollover. And that's when GIS then runs the model to tell us, you know, what's happening. We also use the model to give us an idea of what is actually occurring on the ground and what are we also seeing in terms of our assumptions. I don't want to, I can say that the model is not housed in my shop. It is housed and maintained in our GIS department. Secondly, the planning department do not have any authority to change any of the planning assumptions. Only the council can do so. And there are what I call safeguards in the model. What does that mean? Before the results of the output of the model is published, we have a mechanism to send that information, maps and data, to all our 7 cities, for them to review that information and then provide us feedback before the VBLM is published. Also through GIS, there is a site where Bob posts that same information to our stakeholders. Folks like Jerry Olsen and other stakeholders have access to the same information. They review it, provide us their critique. Following that, that's when the model output of the model is published. So there are checks and balances built into the model. The other thing I wanted to say is that the model is also a reflective of the policies that are in our countywide planning policies, because the countywide planning policies is what binds the county and our local jurisdiction together in terms of regional issues, for example, on housing. Our countywide planning policy that relates to housing focus on what is what we call a tiered density for each of the seven cities. For example, in the case of Vancouver UGA, the assumption is that as their single family areas designated for single family developed, as well as their multi-family areas designated for multi-family develops, that the average density in the Vancouver UGA will be 8 units to an acre. In Battleground, Commerce, Richfield, and Washougal, the average density is assumed to be 6. Then for La Centre, the density is 4. There are no density assumptions or target for the town of Yakult because they don't have sewer. So that is in our countywide planning policy. And how do changes, what changes have we made? There were changes made to the model, I believe, in 2004-07 growth plan update. And those changes were made based on studies that Bob Poole conducted, shared with the public. The cities weighed in on that, and then we came before the council in a public hearing to hear from the public before those changes were made. That's how changes are made to the model. So with that, let me turn it over to...
I have a quick question. Yes. Sorry, before you turn it over. So you talked about the changes that were made. What years were they made?
I believe it was in 2004-07.
Right, we had the 2004 plan we put out, then we did it again right away in 2007.
Okay. And what changes were made at that point?
A lot of changes were made. What allowed was from 94 to 2004, we just kind of kept running the model. When we got there, people were going, well, how's the model working? And we found things like how we were deciding about environmental constraints, where like if 40% of the parcel is environmentally constrained, it's one thing. If it's 60%, it's another. And what we found was people were reconfiguring parcels, right? You do a boundary line adjustment or reconfigure for a subdivision, and the changes would throw a parcel in or out of the model, and we were getting wild swings in what was being considered built or not. We also, the underutilized calculation, what's underutilized and what's not, was extremely complicated. It's like if you're zoned this and you're this size and you're this, there were four different methods for determining what's underutilized, and we went to a much simpler method for understanding underutilized, which was to look at the building value per acre and trying to see if we can find a threshold of what's the building value per acre that will eventually redevelop.
So when we look at the residential planning, model planning assumptions today, are they, I don't know if they're in this PowerPoint, but they're in the issue paper. Are they in the PowerPoint?
No, they're not.
Okay, so they're in the issue paper. When was the last time these were updated, these planning assumptions? Was it the 2004-07? Okay, so it's been 11 to 15
right.
years.
Right, and we even went back and ran the 2007 model back on all the historical years so that the data is consistent throughout. When we try and compare year to year, it works.
Okay.
Final thing I would say, councillors, is that because we use the model for planning purposes, for GMA planning, it is subject to an appeal. And I will also say that because of that, the environmental community and the building community have appealed the VBLM, and we have successfully defended it. I just want to put that word out there because it is what we do, and Taylor is here to answer any questions that you may have. But I just want to make sure that I put that out there for the council.
There's one thing we know, that pretty much anything we do with regard to GMA will be appealed by somebody.
That's right.
So I don't want that to be a reason why we don't.
No, that's
look at what we're doing and the reasons.
Councillor, that's
doing,
not what Oliver is saying, that we can't make any changes. All I'm saying is that because we use it as a tool for planning, that it has been subject to appeal, and we have successfully defended it. That's all I want to say. If you recall the last appeal, the FutureWise appealed it based on the need question and using our work, the VBLM, and the plan monitoring report as a mechanism to appeal. That's all I just want to communicate.
Yeah.
The other thing that after Bob finishes his presentation, I would like to show you is that we do collect building permit information on a monthly basis from each of the seven cities, and we also collect the same similar information from our building division. So we have that data on our website. Anyone can go and look at it. We also have a map that shows you where all the building permits are issued in the county, so you can see that visually. That's also on our website. The other thing that we are required to do by statute is the buildable lands report that we are supposed to submit to the state 5 years before, every 5 years. So that is something that also my shop does. So let me turn it over to you may have other questions as we go to.
I just want to make a comment, too, following on Councillor Olson's comment about, you know, lawsuits being filed because it's part of GMA. I think that what we need to think about when we approach this is accuracy, is actual accuracy, and not be fearful of being sued, you know, as part of our planning. And I'm sure that that's what you want to attain. But I think that would be the most important thing, rather than any fear of being litigated against, because we will be.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Is this thing on?
Yep.
Okay. So what I'm asked to do is really kind of give a summary of where we are today in the buildable lands model, not so much go into the details of how it works. So hopefully it's going here. So some of the questions I was asked to address is how much additional housing capacity remains in our UGAs? Where is this capacity? How well does the GMA housing estimate match actual development? And then if I could bring up the accuracy question. And one of the other concerns was the amount of, is the new environmental regulations impacting capacity and subdivisions? One of the issues that keeps coming back is how much infrastructure are we putting into subdivisions, and is that increasing? And that's something that I'll try to address. One of the things that's really changed since I last spoke with everybody is the computing world keeps changing, and it's much easier for us to do these analyses, and it's actually much easier to share this information on the web. So as part of this, all the presentation, or all the material I'm presenting, is available on the web in what's called a story map, which will show all the graphs and explanation of what that graph's showing. It also has all the underlying maps as interactive maps, so you can go ahead and check the data and see my work, and if you have questions, please let me know. One of the challenges with the vacant lands data is it is what I would call big data. There's lots of it, and it can be very noisy. When we talk about a subdivision, we think of, you know, 30, 40, 50 lots in a standard nice-looking subdivision. But when I go work with the subdivision database, there's a lot of 5-6-unit subdivisions with no infrastructure. There's commercial plots in there that I had to weed out that had no houses. So really scrubbing that data and throwing out the anomalies. And even when you see a normal-looking subdivision, they may have replatted that thing 4 or 5 different times. So that looks like a 40-unit subdivision was replatted into 5-7-unit plots, and the infrastructure got left out of the subdivision. So there's a lot of noise, but there's a lot of data, so you can get some good numbers. So we're trying to cover some of that. The first thing I want to talk about really is where are we at in terms of trends. This is one of the most important graphs we have, because it shows from 1996 to 2018 how much additional housing capacity remains inside our UGAs. And you can see back when we started this in 96, we had over 65,000 units that we could build. And then we got down in 2004, 2007, where people were saying, oh, there's no land left, land prices are going up, and we really increased the capacity by expanding our UGAs. Then through the 2007 through 13, we had that big recession where not much was happening, and it's picked up. And we're getting back down to that same threshold we were in back in 2004, 2007, where this 40,000, 50,000 number is at, I don't know, it seems to get people anxious. One of the changes I'm showing this is I used to show it as the gross acres of developable land, and this has switched to showing actual housing units. And we're going to change the discussion from acres to housing units, because when you look at just the gross acres, that's when all the real assumptions play in after we take gross acres to net acres and then get to housing units, where we some areas are higher density development, some is lower density development. We actually have residential development on commercial property and mixed use spaces. So if we just look at gross acres, that all kind of gets lost. When we get down to the housing yield, we're down to just as reality.
Can I just ask a question about the capacity? So when you're looking at the capacity based, are you looking at what the zoning is then when you take a parcel?
So the vacant local lands model starts with a comprehensive plan, which is very similar to zoning at this point. There's not a lot of difference, but we do take the comprehensive plan, and then we simplify that down. So in the case of residential, we simplify all the residential zoning and comprehensive plan down to low density and high density.
Okay. So it's just that. So I guess following on that, what I wanted to know is, since we have ADUs in the urban areas that are allowed, do you count those as capacity on each one of the lots?
Great question. No, we don't.
No.
You don't?
We really start with this notion of you're a vacant land, right? You're
okay.
You're a vacant land.
ADUs are not included.
I really hope to look at, and this was some of that redevelopment, especially with all the apartment buildings and stuff going up. Where is that developing on? What did we say was going to happen there? I really ran out of time. I'm really, the infrastructure question, I really focused on subdivision development.
Okay.
Bob, is this countywide or is this just within the UGA?
Within the UGA.
Okay.
And this takes that same data and says, well, where's the housing capacity by the city? And you can see the big red spikes here is Vancouver's got the majority of the additional capacity. You can really say it's the Vancouver UGA that's got all the additional capacity out there. And then you can take the same graph and then take Vancouver out of there so we can see what the other cities actually look like. And then this again looks at just the window from 2007 to 2017. And you can see the battleground's kind of the leader there. Battleground, Camas, and Ridgefield were all pretty similar. And then out of that, they had it. Their capacities are not necessarily decreasing. You can see Battleground is increasing here from, was it 16 to 17? The real cost for increasing in capacity is the cities will rezone things or change their comprehensive plan designation. But, you know, you lose jobs and you gain houses. The other thing I was asked to look at, well, let's look at job land. The job land, you know, it's the commercial and industrial. There hasn't been a big change in that. That's still kind of flat. So jobs are, we don't spend much time talking about that, and we really don't have good data on the ground as to where the jobs actually exist versus houses. We know exactly where they're built from the accessory front. We don't have good information on where jobs are. So today's focus is about the housing capacity. So one of the challenges about looking at housing capacity is that vacant global land really starts out looking at the parcel level. You know, is this parcel vacant or not? And that's really a tough way to look at the data because it's really noisy at that level. So one of the things I really thought about this time is how can I aggregate this information so we can really show where is the housing? We need to find something to aggregate things that's somewhere between the parcel level and looking at the whole UGA or the whole county because it gets muddled. And one of the things I thought about is what about the city block? Now, if we take the county right-of-way, nobody owns it, so it's a good way to split up by maps to what's inside the blocks. Those blocks downtown, we think about it, what's a city block, I get that. As you move out in the rural area, those blocks get bigger and bigger and bigger because there's not roads cutting through them, which is kind of cool because if you want contiguous properties to aggregate them and build subdivisions, it kind of starts to aggregate these buildable lands into chunks that might actually be developed. So with that, you know, I can start to show, well, here's the blocks, city block type of analysis, showing the blocks that have residential capacity in them, or have capacity in them, additional capacity. And then they're color-coded by how much capacity. So you can see that big red block kind of in the middle there, that's our big block that's got lots of capacity in it. And it's still hard to interpret what that's saying. So one way to do that is kind of extrude it into a 3D view. Now you look at this as a 3D view. The height of these different blocks shows how much capacity is in them. And what's kind of cool there is you do see there's this band of development out there where we're working. There's nothing left in Vancouver. They're gone. But we know they're building in Vancouver, lots of apartments and stuff. So there's something there that's worth further exploring. We also have this concept of Camas Lake is or Salmon Creek, these artificial barriers will prevent that right away from splitting it up into equal sized things. So this is a, distorts the data somewhat, but you've got these bigger areas that are a little bit artificial. But I think it shows us some trends. The next thing that Oliver asked is, well, one of the things we have is all this land that's in urban holding that we can't develop yet because we're waiting for infrastructure. And we have this question, well, how much is in urban holding and where is it? So using those same extruded blocks, we can see that the brown stuff here is what's in urban holding. You can see where it is, and by the height there, you can see kind of the magnitude of it. And we actually have quite a bit of land in urban holding. Really, the highways, I think, is the big really factor to getting those guys into industrial development. This area, again, really very interesting. So then the next question, I guess, still in this urban holding question, how much capacity is tied up in urban holding? And this shows how much, how many additional housing units are available by UGA by urban holding.
Councillors, in the case of this graph, if I may add, the only urban holding in the Vancouver UGA where you see in all this capacity is in the 179th.
Yeah.
And in the 179th estimates, I don't have accurate estimate that I can share, but the estimate is that there's a potential over 5,500 potential new jobs in the 179 urban holding and more than 5,600 housing units, again, in the 179 corridor. The other urban holdings are just for the smaller cities. And as you know, for the smaller cities, the urban holding within their jurisdiction is through annexation. And for them also, planning for when those sewer, water, and fire are going to be provided before those areas can develop.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea what kinds, what sorts of jobs you're talking about in that area?
It's predominantly commercial type of office, light industrial for in terms of the zoning.
Yeah,
light industrial and commercial zoning, yes.
So the other big question that comes in really, that's kind of the summary where we're at with how the knowledge are. This question comes up all the time about subdivision infrastructure, how much is there? So I really took a lot of time this time to really take a deep dive into what is the infrastructure in subdivisions, and we went through all the subdivisions, certainly since, this goes back all the subdivisions since 94, but we've paid special attention to the recent subdivisions from 2013 to 2017 to make sure their data was current in the assessor's database to show how those parcels are planned to develop. And what that really means is identifying the tracts that are not going to develop versus the lots that are going to develop into houses. And so on this map, you can see this blue areas are set aside for wetlands. This green area is just a tract. We're not clear enough that it's going to be a wetlands tract or not. And then you can also see the right-of-way is shaded. So when we look at infrastructure, we can compare the yellow to everything else and get an infrastructure by subdivision.
So, Bob, this makes sense when we get to the level of doing a subdivision, but what do we account for land that is zoned residential but then gets sold and becomes a park? And we just sold some land up by Austin Heritage. So that would show as being available for housing capacity until the point that it's sold and then rezoned as a park. Same with schools, other kinds of public facilities. Are those factors calculated into the infrastructure deduction?
So the infrastructure deduction is an assumption that was agreed upon by the councilors. And that number, I think, is what,
27.7.
It was really based on a similar type of analysis to go look at some subdivisions. There was more of a limited set of subdivisions
right
back then. And this one says, well, let's look at all the subdivisions and try to get the data as clean as we can to get the infrastructure percentage.
So it's only looking at it from the point where a developer comes in with a plat and says, here's what we're going to do, and we figure out how much of, you know, the 40 acres or 10 acres that's going to be developed goes into streets, the things that are listed there.
Right.
Okay.
We've had lengthy discussions about some of the other infrastructure, like people were talking about the interstates and whatnot. I'm like, well, I'm not sure we're going to build another interstate, so we set aside that for that. lot of the school districts seem to buy their hat outside the UGA and then ask if we could bring it inside the UGA because they couldn't afford it.
Right.
So we find a lot of these anecdotal stories to try and say there's more introduction into accounting for it. How do you figure that out? It's always really difficult to pin down. And this is one place we can really pin it down and say, look at areas we've built, what's happened. And I think it's an interesting question you bring up because I'm going to do some more talking about, let's look at the areas we've built and see what happens, right? Even when we look at the areas that are built, well, there's assumptions to say there's some land's never going to be developed. Well, the land that's never going to be developed never should be a developed area. So it's a skewed data set. So all these things are, you know, kind of give us some guidance. And in the end, the decisions are the council's. That's how these assumptions play out. It's not entirely based on the numbers that I'm getting.
Thank you.
So when you look at the infrastructure and subdivisions, this gives you that whole list of all subdivisions over time. And actually, this is from, it's 2007 onwards. So it's pretty consistent no matter how big the data set. These numbers don't change because it's a large data set. And you can see the mean is about 27.8 and the median is 25.7. The challenge I face with these numbers, if you look at the chart, you'll see there's a lot of them with no infrastructure at all, right? This is your 5-6 unit subdivision that really has no roads. They have nothing. And then you get these ones out here that kind of turn into all infrastructure because there's these weird oddball subdivisions out there. Mm-hmm. So I start making all these assumptions and throwing data out. I'm like, wait, man, you can't be, who do you decide who's in and who's out? So in the end, you know, here's the bell curve and we're in the ballpark.
How far back does that go?
You know, looking at our, I would have to say this was, I apologize, I didn't put it down here because it's 2 weeks old. I'm going to guess it's 2007 onward, just based on the numbers. And there was a chart out there with all of them.
Yeah, what we asked our councilors, what we asked Bob to do was to look at what have happened until 2007 and also look at subdivision and development that have come in since the stormwater regulation went into effect so that we can see what are we really looking at on the ground. So if there is any adjustment needs to be made, we can use that data to make that. So that's part of the thing that we asked.
What was the year on that change for stormwater?
Stormwater, I believe stormwater went into effect in 2013.
I've looked at this so many different ways. All the from 1996 to present, 2007 to present, 2013 to present, and they're pretty much the same. The bigger the data set I like, this is a smaller data set, so it's the 2007 data set. What's more important, what I wanted to look at more than was this question that Oliver brings to the table. Is it changing over time, right? With the new stormwater regulations, are we getting more infrastructure? Is it getting harder to develop if we're getting more infrastructure? So one of the things we looked at, well, what's the median infrastructure for the subdivisions by year? So this one's really cool. This would show us, is it trending up now since the 2013 regulations? And you can still see it's kind of noisy data. We're hovering around it, 25, and it goes down, and it goes up. And here it goes crazy, and then we're up, and we're back down again. So tough to get trends on that. I'm kind of going, what's going on here? One of the things that's really interesting is if you look at subdivisions by reporting date, you know, we see some trends. We have a lot of subdivisions. So there are 100 subdivisions back in 99. You know, we're averaging in the 60, the 100, and boom, the recession hit. There's no subdivisions here. The one subdivision we had back here in 2008 really skews that year. That's the answer for that year, is that one subdivision. And quite frankly, in the recession years, these weren't normal subdivisions. They were replats and this and that's that people were going. So is that a really bad set of data going on right in the middle of our charts? It's kind of hard to work on. So again, we say there's the low volume here, so sure enough, we get really noisy data. And I don't know what's going on this year, but we're really bummed it down. So we're still, even when you look at it, the number's still in that same 27% range. It's not a bad number.
Hey, Bob. How do these numbers compare with the different UGAs, like Ridgefield, for instance, who has a set aside to like 25% set aside for parks and miscellaneous stuff? Is this, I mean,
that's a great question. I think we can get these million dollar UGA budget.
Okay, yeah, I think because it adds to the planning assumption generally if they already have a 25%+ in addition to additional infrastructure.
I think one of the really cool things is how easy it is for me to create these charts now than in the past. So really, to tell me what more charts you want to see in information really helps, because this is a sample of what's possible. I'd be very interested to see what I want you guys to see.
Okay, hey,
Bob, we're kind of coming out of this, but I'm thinking the last year we've had a lot of subdivisions that have been approved coming from even before the recession. So before the recession, the curbs and the roads were built, you know, four or five banks have owned it, and now they're finally building the homes. Is that infrastructure back there, or is it now?
Those Since are it's, some of the ones they're replatting them, too. Like you say,
yeah.
The roads are built, they got this big one, and they replatted on the UDs 8. And
okay.
They didn't include no infrastructure because the road.
But that's why.
There.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
What are you doing that?
That would mess it up.
One of the challenges I look at is, well, have you been replatted? You know, are you sitting on top of another subdivision? And there may be noisy data. I don't know.
Right. Okay.
And I kind of, you know, well, if I'm throwing that guy out, what about am I being fair on the other side? So that's why I'm like, let's
interesting.
Just put all the data in.
Yeah.
One of the things I also got into is we discussed the infrastructure issue, which is a good one, but that's why, you know, infrastructure, again, is looking more at that gross acres. I really wanted to look at how many units we have passed we're going to be building this subdivision, and how many units did we get, right? So it really takes in all the issues around, this is, okay, you're building a subdivision in constrained land, right? We already said you're not going to get a lot of houses there because it's constrained, right? We also have these other things that the infrastructure one never to develop. All these factors play into it. So I really want to look at it from the actual units built to what we forecast we can build in that area. And with that then, so here's a map of that. And what I had to do then was for every subdivision, I'd look at the recording year, and then I'd go find the vacant buildable lands model from the year before it was recorded. So we can see, well, what the vacant buildable lands model say was going to be built there. In this case, it's kind of interesting. You can see this one is one of those cases where, oh, it was already built before we said there was going to be a subdivision there, right? That would be something where maybe the underutilized was a little too restrictive, and so that land is never going to develop, and yet it did. We have, and what's interesting, these are also highlighted by did they meet the forecast or not. So this one here has a lot of critical land, and it's outlined in red, which means that there are at least two units less than were forecast to be built in that. This one's in blue. We said nothing was going to be built there, and we built some houses, so it's well above what the model forecast. And there's actually one in green that we got it right. The model said there's going to be so many houses, and we got it. So that's one way to look at where we're being successful and where we're not being successful.
Do you have the actual, like, unit count for each of those?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. And that's available online. So
it is on, yeah. You can go online and play with it. Click on it. It will show you.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Bob.
So, do you know what, the, I'm sorry. Do you know what the, if you added all those up, are we plus or minus?
I
think
so. Just a quick inside the, there's these story maps I put out there with links on this page so you can go out and look at this data. I've also added some links in the PowerPoint that will go out and show you these maps so you can actually go out there and interrogate them yourself. A lot of demonstration. I don't like to do that. You can see this whole, for interesting ones where it's was comprehensive plan commercial and turned into a subdivision. And you have places where there's commercial land or industrial lands that turn into a subdivision. So each one of these is a new category. Click on one. It will show you the percent infrastructure. It's got information on here about the actual housing. Estimate versus actual, percent of estimate. So all that information is out there so you can see what we do for each subdivision. So please check my word and let me know if it's weird. There's weird data out there. I don't see. You can also put that in kind of a 3D perspective view, which is kind of cool again because you get the magnitude. So the ones in blue are how much over the estimate they were, and the ones in red are how much under the estimate we were. And again, the green ones are flat because we got it right. And you can see there's some interesting trends in here. Up here you see a lot of places where we're really not hitting the estimates, and down here in central Vancouver, we seem to hit them pretty well. And really one of the big drivers for do we hit the yields or not, you know, I was looking, is it constrained, is it not constrained? It really got down to lot size. You know, if you're building really nice houses on large lots, like we do up in Philida, you generally don't hit the yields. We build more higher density subdivisions in here, we hit the yields. So that's just an observation on that. We probably looked at a little more in depth. So then if we take a look at all of the subdivisions again from 96 to today, and look at the distribution of the housing yield versus the forecast, what we find is that there's a real spiky thing here. What we find is the mean is we get 8 more units than we forecast on a subdivision. And the line doesn't seem to line up here, but that's what it looks like. The negatives, right, would be lower than here, the ones where they miss. Well, the next thing you can do is say, well, let's look at it by percent, because if you're saying it, let's just look at the percent yield difference. And that is squirrely because, like we said, we found on subdivision that we said nothing was going to be built there. And you take zero forecast divided by the number you get. It's a big number. So you see all these ones aggregated out here, all the ones where we said we weren't going to get any houses and we got some houses. And like we said, we'll make that 500% because that's smaller than infinity. It makes my graph fit on the paper.
Hey, Bob, how does the... We talked about the city of Vancouver having no available land, but we know they're building and they're building up. How does that influence that? Is that counted into this median number?
So in this discussion, we're just talking about subdivisions.
Okay.
We've got this question about the infrastructure of subdivision question.
Okay.
And I think there's a lot of questions to me about redevelopment. And if we're building as apartment buildings, what do we say is going to happen on that land? And I really want to get a chance to look into that. Quite frankly, I ran out of time. Those some areas we'd like to do some more research on, certainly I think that's a great idea. So in looking at this chart, what you'd want to see is everything should be towards 100%, right? That we got 100% of the yield we forecast. Right? And you can see that 100%, there's a lot of stuff over 100%. Most of the subdivisions are getting more yield than they were forecast. But again, you have do have factors like never to develop in as part of that yield forecast. That we're doing. So with that, that's kind of what I said I was going to talk about. I did want to show again some of the resources online for you, because I think that's really important. One of the things we have now in GIS is this ability to create what are called story maps. And that's a way where I can include all my charts up here. And I can give a little blurb of all the stuff I thought I did, more details, views. So you can please click through here and look at this. And also, when we see some of these cool 3D graphs, there's links in here to go look at that in an interactive manner also. It's pretty cool for a web browser. extruded blocks, you can see that that big one back in 2007, we said there's room for another 1,800 houses there, and we said there were 200 houses at that time. And in 2018, we're down to only 1,700 houses left for capacity, and we now have 464 houses there. So you kind of see what we said was going to happen, what happens, and kind of look at the magnitude of some of these things. So it's quite a bit of capacity in that block. There's lots of other fun maps and charts to look at, and these story maps. And again, these are just kind of the tip of the iceberg of what I can show. If you have other questions or charts you'd like to see, I'd be happy to work on the results.
But we have, as we get more and more data on individual lands, especially after the new stormwater permit comes through, it may be a far-reaching question out there, but it seems like we have enough data and we have soil maps of the county to some extent. Is there any correlation about saying, all right, as we go north and north, whatever, land's going to get harder, but the soil types are different. Is there any correlation about saying, you know, Cascade Park, you know, it's this much, but if you have another land type, another soil structure, you're going to be looking a lot higher infrastructure in a general kind of a point of view?
That's a good question. I think, you know, when I looked at, try and look at that, like I said, where are we hitting the yields and where are we not?
Right.
Is it the constrained lands really driving that? And, you know, more and more you look at where the constrained lands are, and I think out in Flamida is a good example. You know, all those houses they're building on the ridge, you're right, they've got constrained lands and they can't build houses down the hill slope, but they're building very nice big
right,
houses
yeah.
to use. It's very desirable. Huh. And I think even where the Street of Dreams homes were, right? We didn't hit the yields there. They're very large lots, very desirable as they overlook the stream. So there's issues
okay.
around that, right? There's other places, but if you look in Vancouver and say there's not much land left, and some of those you can look and see the vacant land is in a corridor, and everything in that stream corridor has been turned into greenways at this point.
Oh, uh-huh.
And you can say, you know what? They're probably not going to build there. That's going to be a greenway.
Right.
And you go, okay, why are we saying, why are we zoning that residential?
Yeah.
We're not going to build there. Why are we zoning that parks and open space? Because in some ways we throw these lands in and then say, well, they're not going to develop. That doesn't seem to make sense. I think it makes sense to places you add to personal opinion. You get to the urban rural area, you shouldn't have a lot of environmental constraints.
Right. As we look at the maps, so we have two similarities. We have a 2004 when housing was really, there wasn't much land available. And really we have now, are they similar or do the pictures look similar between 2004 when lot prices were heading up and that's why we did essentially the 2007 plan compared to now that maybe we should... I'm trying to get, should we look at a sooner, trying to get a new plan sooner than 7 years? And so, is there anything to look at them to?
I think that's the slide I started out with.
Yeah.
Right here, right? This is
right
the
there.
Key one.
Yeah.
It says how much housing is left. And I think you have an interesting idea. Like you said, back in this time frame, you said, well, there's no land left, right? Added all this capacity, and now we've consumed almost all of that again. So we are getting back here, and we go, okay, what's going on with all this land? Why isn't it undevelopable? I mean, you could say there's undeveloped, the model's wrong, but is it 45,000 units wrong?
Right.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think there's an interesting question about why we have this much land, and we're saying it's not buildable. And to actually take that a step further than I started with, right? If we say there's all that land that's not developable, then I would expect that we wouldn't see this pattern. I've been here, there's no land left. It's built out. And we have these areas out here that clearly we're seeing there's land to develop out on the fringe. So
Bob,
this is my opinion. These are your choices.
Yeah.
Can you go back to that last slide that has the one 20 years back? Yeah, that would be really interesting to overlay that with housing prices, because there's almost a perfect inverse relationship there in terms of where prices were at when we were at that really low point in 2005 and 6, and then where we're at now in terms of affordability, both for rentals and for purchase observation.
Because it's interesting, 2006 says we have probably developers, you know, so there's 45,000, you know, lots, okay, in 2006 or 2004. So in 2004, developers were paying everything in the world, just throwing money at some of these places. When, if there's really 45,000 homes available, you would have thought, well, why am I going to give this farmer so-and-so many thousands an acre when there's land available? So the market and I don't know where that fits.
Yeah, looking at what lot prices are over the last 3 years, there's only been a little bit of that housing capacity that's been eaten up, but lot prices have gone
right, significantly
higher than what that graph would kind of indicate.
And Bob, I think you asked great questions with regard to data and how do we get to it and how do we understand it. And the more you ask those questions and we ask those questions, whatever these decisions are up to us, but we have to have as much data as possible in order to get there. And so, you know, I think whatever you can do to continue to dig into it for us and figure out why does this make sense or not make sense, the better position we are to make some decisions about it. And if we have folks in the community that have questions about the data and want to provide us some input, that would be helpful too. So,
you had asked if there was additional data we would like. One thing I think might be helpful looking back at the last 3 years of that median infrastructure deduction of actual projects, of what was kind of the breakdown, maybe just by zoning, of those projects. Were those going to be higher density development or lower density, and is there any correlation there between, we had that big drop in 2017 in terms of the infrastructure development. Is there a trend there in terms of what kind of land based on zoning is being developed? And that might give us an idea of, okay, going forward, if there was low infrastructure development because it was all this kind of zoning, but now that zoning is limited, where are we going with that? Does that make sense? Question?
Perhaps. I think that you're going to find the data pretty thin to do that, to be honest. There's just not that many subdivisions. And it's good about by zoning, you're going to get the noise overrun.
Too much noise.
You can take a look at it. I think one of the interesting things that I have looked at is, you know, as you increase the density, right, you have more smaller lots, you actually get more roads in there to service those smaller lots, right? So the smaller lots, the more roads you have.
And I think that was kind of the point I was getting to was, yeah, how does the type of zoning impact the infrastructure reduction?
And again, when we do that, when we look at those infrastructure ones, the zoning ones, you know, it gets a big number away, right? You look at everything I do with infrastructure, it looks like this. You get this pie chart, and it's around 30. You know, every way I slice it and dice it, it's 27, 30, 30, I'm just like, come on, you should be changing. All these different ways, and it seems pretty solid, and that's it. I'm not sure that infrastructure number is changing that much. I think, really, one of the things I want to try and think about is changing the thought process to consider more about yield, right? Because yield is actually how many houses we're getting out of it based on all of our assumptions, just not the one assumption. And there could be a tendency here to want to turn this knob way up, and ignoring you've got these other knobs turned way up, right? We're already over forecasting the number of housing units we're thinking we're going to get in our subdivisions. So any turning that knob up is going to make that. But I'll say, well, what knob would you turn down to try and get anything closer to our forecast? And again, I'd say, do we even want to do that? I don't like changing the model because it's such a rich history. Right? If you say, you can say that our model is under forecasting in new subdivisions. Okay, that's okay. It's under forecasting by a little bit in new subdivisions. That's okay, because you know there's never to convert land and all that land you converted. So some of the assumptions don't play in. I like the model being stable as long as it has, because it gives us this rich data issue.
As long as we can account for some of those anomalies, though, in our plan. So, yeah, that's the issue, is if it's in the model, how constrained are we by the model versus, you know, what we can actually do.
Right, as counselors, we can actually make the call.
And I think the challenge for me is, while the model seems to be projecting, there's a disconnect between what the model says should be happening within the market and what's actually happening. And so when it comes down to people being able to afford houses or apartments being able to be built at an affordable rate, that's not happening. So somewhere there's a breakdown between what we're modeling the outcome should be compared to what's actually happening on the ground. There's some disconnect there, and I don't think we know what that is at this point, but I think that's where we as a board need to work towards, okay, how do we make the end result actually people being able to afford houses?
And part of that's a supply and demand question.
That is more of a policy decision for the council, but the model doesn't look at affordable housing. It doesn't look at what the market is asking for any given property. So we can measure, say, housing affordability index differently, but that's not what the model is structured to do.
But as we go through GMA, we're constrained by this model. So that's, I understand what you're saying, that yes, this model isn't meant to project that, but somewhere along the way, there's something we got to fix, either it's how we use the model and what the next steps are,
right,
or if it's looking at the model to find a way to make it better track with the market and what's actually happening.
Right.
Because perhaps it's saying that we have more than we actually have to use,
which changes
the price. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing that may be helpful, Bob and Oliver, to talk about as we talk about the next steps in using the model is to talk about the legislation that was recently passed,
right,
and what effects that may have on our model going into the next comp plan.
You're right, Lindsay. It is too soon to say what will happen. I know that the bill calls for different ways of measuring what is available for development. I can say that, and Bob will agree, that our model has some of the issues raised in the new bill 5254, has some of that built in into our model already. What do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. We have assumptions of 10% of the vacant land won't convert. We have assumption that almost 30% of our underutilized will not convert. We have ways of accounting for infrastructure, for example. Mm-hmm. We don't have, for example, a tree ordinance. So that wouldn't be an issue for us, for example. So there are certain things that is in 5254 that our model already accounts for. Areas where we may, and even in requirement to account for infrastructure gap, we are using urban holding to get us to that question. So some of those are already accounted for. Areas where we will have some issues, not issues, but challenge, is the provision to account for willingness of a property owner to sell their property. That, I'm not sure how we're going to get that information. Remember also that in the model, and also by the action of the council, we do provide for what is called a reasonable market factor. And you may say, what is that? That is, in the supply side, you have to designate more land to account for market fluctuation or when property owners decide to sell. So those are some of the issues that we'll look at when the guidelines comes out. How will we then hopefully amend or not amend our model? But we'll see what the guidelines, when the guidelines come out. I do have something I wanted to pass out to the councilors. This is from Commerce. This is their timeline for when the guideline is supposed to come out. My understanding is that there is a requirement in the legislature to coordinate the new guidelines with the Rocco House memo dealing with GMA issues. So it's likely that we may not get that guideline until after December of this year.
Hmm.
I don't know if you have anything to add.
I don't.
Okay. There's one other thing I just want to show the council quickly. Jose, can you pull that up? We're almost done. So this information is on our website. This is information that each of the local jurisdiction, that is all the seven cities, they provide us on a monthly basis, the building permit, single family, or all the building permit in their jurisdiction. And we collect this by single family, ADU, all types of housing types. So this information comes to us, and then we get the same building information from our building division. And we have it, you know, year by year. You can also see, then we look at what is the density by each of the UGA, based on the number of information that, based on the information we're receiving from the cities. This is also mapped. You can see a map of, this is countywide, and this is for 2017. You can see where all the building permit issued for 2017 are, including the rural area. This information, again, is provided to us by the cities and our own building division. It is available on our website. Anyone can go and view them. Just want to let the council know that this is the type of work that we also do.
Back to the buildable lands.
Yes.
You're counting in the rural area, and there's a remainder lot. Do you take that? Do you use that remainder lot as it is that it can't be built on? Do you add that in?
We addressed this issue when it came up during the 16 plan update.
So you're talking about cluster.
Cluster,
yeah,
the remainder.
Cluster,
yes.
Development. So we modified that so that remainder lots aren't counted
good
for any additional development.
Right.
And we make sure to flag those on the plats.
Yes. Yeah, that was adjusted,
okay.
Corrected. And also, just as a passing, Jose, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a provision in our code and maybe in a policy that will change when that property is brought into the UGB. Is that
so
correct?
There's no capacity on that cluster remainder lot unless it's brought into the urban growth boundary.
Unless it's brought into the urban growth boundary and
so
the zoning change.
And then the remainder requirement no longer applies?
Yes,
right.
Only when it's brought into the UGB.
I thought they were covenanted into perpetuity.
They can be.
Unless the zoning changes when you brought
okay
into the UGB. That's my understanding.
On an individual basis, but I don't think that's
okay
ever seen anybody.
All right.
Yeah. But we did make the correction.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my question, Oliver, is so in 2004, we were down to 45,000 lots, 45,000. We're down to 45,000, about the same now. However you want to figure that in, as John was talking about prices and everything else, do we take that, I think in 2004, we changed it because lot prices were going way up. I don't, we had some of those figures that was very good. So do we start thinking about looking at the plan sooner? And do we, I don't want to get down to 35,000 or whatever and say, oh, wow, guess what? I can't afford to live here. So do we take some of these numbers and start really saying, regardless if we want to or not, we're going to be looking at the plan sooner than the 7 years?
My response would be yes, the council can. Remember, there are certain things that have to happen along the way. One is that the Office of Financial Management mm-hmm will still have to provide us some population estimate up to 2045 or up to 2050. That's one. The second thing that needs to happen is that according by statute, this 5254, there's a provision in it that counties have to complete this 2 years prior to the next 3 years. They have to complete the report 3 years prior to.
There's some exceptions for two, but for us it's three.
Oh, for Clark County and the cities it's three. So we have to complete this review 3 years prior to opening up our comp plan. And given the fact that they're telling us that this will come out December of 18 and maybe into 19, you know, so that will be something that the council will have to consider. I don't know.
So are you saying the plan that the bill that isn't implemented yet has to be done 3 years before we open the plan up?
That's what it says.
I mean, good grief.
And the other thing that it says, councilors, is if there is no funding to do the work, we revert to the old way the counties.
I hope there's no funding.
Yeah. So those are some of the things that we will bring to the table for your consideration before you decide to open up the plan. But I'm just letting you know what things that we have to consider. But you're right, we are coming closer to where we were in 04. The only comment I will also make is that if we were to, particularly in the Vancouver UGA, if we were to start early and any land that we bring into the UGB now, we have to apply up and hold into it.
Right.
Okay? So the issue again will be, at least in the short term, it will appear as those lands are available. Because you're planning for 20 years, you will say it's available. But in the short term, it's not. Because until you address the infrastructure, both sewer and road, that land is off limit, even if you bring it into the UGB. You take the 179, for example. All those lands, we said is available. But in the short term, it's not really available. Because we put that contingent zoning on it. If you look at the smaller cities, even if you expand their urban growth boundary, be it Richfield, Camas, Washougal, you still put urban holding on their property. I'll give you an example. The property that was brought into the Richfield urban growth boundary, the 110 acres, they put urban holding on it themselves, the city of Richfield. They said they're not ready. You know, those are things that happen because of sewer, water, and roads, because this one had they have to do that themselves. Whether they go to their city resident to up the sewer rate or not, that's conversation that they have to have. That's exactly what is happening in Camas and other areas. That's what they're telling me, that they're really focusing on what is happening inside their city limits, and they're not really ready for the areas that are in their urban growth boundaries, if you will. So to answer your question, yes, you can start early, but this other provision will bring those conversations before you to consider. Again, I don't know when OFM will come out with their new population forecast for GMA counties. That will be the first.
But if we're looking at these numbers and we're going to look at an early start, regardless, maybe it's even 3 years sooner, we have to figure the ag issue before anything. We don't do the ag issue.
That's going to be your call, councilors.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.